Accession number 29540, Mr. Norman Cole, Reel 3. Now, so you've explained why you needed this sort of unarmed silent combat training. Now, what was it? What did Kubista, or
Lieutenant Kubista,
what
yeah.
did he teach you?
He was a Czechoslovakian.
What were the methods he was teaching you?
Well, I've never taught people how to do this because the whole thing is dangerous, obviously. But I mean, I even now could stop a person being able to speak with a single blow, and then wouldn't be able to speak again, and could be permanent, the damage too.
Well, what would cause that? You can tell us, don't you?
Well, yes, it would be a chop into the windpipe to collapse the windpipe totally. That would be the silent point of view. We had to find that we could kill them by using their helmet. For instance, a German helmet was on the head and a strap under the chin. So if you put your hand over the helmet and jerked it back rapidly, you'd break his neck. So again, he wouldn't be able to talk, would he? Not very well, anyway.
And any other techniques? What else do you remember?
Well, I know could pin somebody in such a way that they couldn't move, and I could do that with one hand quite without any difficulty, so you could get someone, overcome them, and hold them with just a single hand that they couldn't move. I can still do that. If there's anything like a pole or a tree or something like that, I can fix somebody to that in such a way that they can't possibly get away, even if they were naked.
How?
Well, just the way you
explain it in a sort of way we can understand. It's very difficult, I understand, when they're not looking at you. But I mean, so how would you do that? Because that sounds very impressive.
Taking the second one, it's easier to explain the pole. You put their arms around, but in effect, you go around and you tuck one foot. The pole is down there, and you tuck one foot behind the other there. And they've got to hang on to that. You can't move their feet, and they're just stuck there, quite unable to move against the pole. If you weren't sure you're going to be able to come back to them and you wanted them to die, then you lifted their body back so they couldn't hold the pole, and eventually their stomach muscles would split open and they would die. So you could leave them there so they couldn't get away, or you could leave them, and if you didn't come back, you'd have eliminated them. And it's understood, we understood at the time, that this had been used when the troops had landed on the French coast and been repulsed, and they put all our troops in handcuffs, didn't they, for a while. And it was believed that what they'd done, they'd used this grapevine, as it was called, and fixed German soldiers to all sorts of trees and things like that and left them. And that's when they turned around and said, we'd handcuffed them. Don't think we had handcuffed them at all, didn't carry handcuffs. But they'd used this system of elimination and containment.
How did you feel? I mean, you were of a not desperately, but you were of a religious mind. How did you take to this sort of thing? Because it is quite tough. It's quite a tough thing to be expected to do.
Yeah, but there was a difference in my mind, which was very important. I didn't hate Germans as much at that time, but I hated Nazism and what they were doing. I mean, I'd do anything I could to eliminate Nazism. I hated that. So I was quite prepared to learn these things to eliminate something that I considered as quite evil.
What was it you hated about it? I mean, it seems that, you know, but what was it that particularly upset you about it?
Well, the pictures...
People didn't know about the concentration camps then.
Well, we knew quite a bit about what was going on. You know, they were treating the Jews and that and taking them away and putting them into camps. And there were even photographs in the papers and that of what was being done. Yes.
Even then?
Even then.
And that's what made you so...
their treatment of humanity.
Now, any other things you were doing while you were... Where were you billeted at Cruxhaw?
It was in huts.
Just normal huts?
Normal huts.
Now, how long were you there for? I'm sure you don't...
Not very long. Very short period. I couldn't tell you how long, but a matter of a few weeks.
And then you go to Carlbury.
Carlbury.
Which you say is near Peacebridge, but I don't know where Peacebridge is.
Peacebridge, that's not very far from Darlington.
So still in the...
Still in a similar area, yeah.
Now, what were you doing at Carlbury?
Again, it was just continuing training and that. started my motorcycle training there.
Well, tell us about that. Tell about your motorcycle training.
Well, that wasn't easy because the fields there are constructed in ridges, so they drain well because it's so wet up there. And if you're going along the side of a ridge, in fact, it's flat. When you turn, the bike's going up and down and up and down and up and down as you cross the field. And that's not easy, controlling the hand grips on the motorbike. So that wasn't easy learning there. And I certainly didn't become proficient washer there.
There's a story about how you crashed one in the shortest possible time after you'd been given it. Can you tell us that story?
Well, yeah. I was told to pick up a motorbike and bring it back. And I went to this, and this was the first time I'd handled a motorbike this particular time. I didn't realise how heavy they were. And when he gave it to me, it was slightly leaning away from me. And I couldn't stop it going over. So within a couple of seconds of having it, it was on the ground and the lever broken off. Far heavier than I thought they were.
So another just small thing is you seem to be doing something about stones, getting stones from a river. What's that about? We're building a road? Or?
Well, into the campsite, yeah. It was coming in on grass at the moment, and they're trying to improve it, because even if we weren't going to be there, there'd be other troops moving in. And we were
so what were you actually doing? How were you getting the stones? Just getting them from the river, you mean?
Yeah, took a truck down to the river, used to gather these stones and bring them back. Then they'd sledgehammers and smash them up, so they settled into a road surface.
And how good was it?
I don't know, it was good training. I used it for discipline too. I remember there's one poor little Jewish lad, he didn't like working. And nobody had to use a sledgehammer more than he did. They kept him on it.
Now, two exercises you've got down here for Carlbury, and one of them seems particularly interesting, is about your failure in a booby trap exercise of a Nissenhut. Tell us exactly what happened there, because that's quite interesting, because booby traps are quite important.
Well, there was a hut which had all sorts of stores in there, all sorts of military equipment, all sorts, quite a variety. And they deliberately booby-trapped some of the bits of equipment in this hut. And I had to take I don't know how many it was, probably four or five soldiers. I had to take them into this hut and go through from one end and go out the other end without setting off any of these booby-traps. And, you know, I knew what to do, how to, if you came across a coil of camouflage netting, for instance, you had to lift it very carefully and feel underneath to see if there's anything there. If you lifted it straight up, could have a bang. And we were going through, and I was at one of these coils of camouflage netting, and I was slowly lifting it, and bang, I thought, I'm supposed to be the one taking them through. But in point of fact, it wasn't me at all. It was somebody beside me had lifted one up. And I was quite sure it was me to start with. And I felt most guilty.
Now, what booby trap training have you had? I mean, because you must have had formal training at some point to know about this.
I mean, it's only a couple of lessons, really.
Nothing big? Not
intensive? No. And these, of course, were only the detonators. There was no explosive on the detonators.
Okay. Oh, you wouldn't be here.
We wouldn't be here.
The other thing is a wood exercise, you know.
Yes, that was if you had to go, I assume that's what it is.
An exercise where you have to go through a wood without setting any traps off. Just get quite interested.
Yeah. What we had to do, there was paths through this wood, and we were led to believe that there were the enemy soldiers there hiding in the bushes and in the trees and so on. And we had to try and avoid being shot by them in theory. And it was one point, I was clear all of a sudden, one point where we came up to a T-junction. We came up and you had to turn left or right. But we were told we had to turn left. And what I thought was, if I turn left, if there was anybody in the right, they're going to shoot me in the back. And in fact, they did do that. They made a model of a man up in one of the trees to the right. And apparently he was one of the few, if not the only one, who thought of that. So I didn't get shot in the back, but virtually everybody else did. That's why I remember it, because I was good at it.
Now, how did you get on with the locals in the Durham area? You know, generally, I'm talking about both places, both, you know, the Carlbury and the previous one at Coxhoven.
Extremely friendly. I mean, I didn't get involved with any particular, well, one family for a couple of evenings, but we always said that every door was open to us. You could virtually walk into any door and be welcome. They really were sort of overwhelming with their generosity to us, their friendship.
That was a general thing across the board in both places.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Now, the next trip is you go up to Aileth, which is near Dundee, as I understand it. Now, this is a change in focus as well, because the whole unit is being moved to First Corps. Now, would you know that at the time?
Not really. I mean, we would have been told, but it wouldn't have meant anything to us.
So that's more that you've noticed it since, if you see what I mean.
Well, First Corps is a spearhead corps, of course. You were going to be the spearhead of what was going to happen. But I doubt if we knew that at the time.
Now, so what was the setup? Were you in huts again, I presume?
Yes. Yeah.
Now, one thing you're doing there is you're doing commando mountain warfare training, which is not much fun in many cases. Now, tell me what you remember of that.
Well, we used to go out to the mountains, and then we'd have to take our instruments and all the signaling equipment of that up to the near the top of these mountains so we could get good views for our observation work. And then you used to have to set it up and camouflage everything. And you would get a team of officers who were testing you. They'd be on a mountain the other side, or on a road or something the other side. And they would be trying to see if they could identify where you were, if you'd failed to camouflage yourself well enough. And then you'd have to get up there and make phone contact with somebody down the bottom to prove you were there and you'd done it.
So you were actually checking. You were. It wasn't so much commando then. It was you were just setting up a... What would be your battle?
It wasn't fighting commando. It was a bit of fitness commando training.
I'll come back to that. Yeah. But what you were doing with your flash spotting is you were setting up an OP, as you would, on the hills, and then being tested for, A, that you weren't seen by the enemy, and B, that you were in contact with the people, which would be the Royal Artillery. I thought it was the Royal Artillery.
Which meant you had to know exactly where you were. You had to identify your position, that reference position.
So you had to be on the map.
On the map.
Anything else about it? What would be in a typical, you know, when you set up an OP, what equipment would you have in an OP? What was an OP? How many people? Was there an officer? What was an OP?
No, there'd never be an officer.
So what would there be?
There'd be three or four of us normally, because you'd be on a rota system. It'd be only probably two or three of you working at any one time. You'd have the surveying instrument, which was quite a big, heavy instrument.
Now, what was it? Is it like a theodolite?
Yeah, but binocular. Most theodolites are just single eyepiece. These were binocular. And measured angles in the same way.
How did it actually work? Can you describe it for people that would know?
It's as simple as a theodolite, really. It measures angles from one point to another. You log on to one point, swing it around, and see how many degrees you've turned in moving to the second point.
So that's one bit of equipment you'd have at this OP. Yeah. It's a flash spotting OP, isn't it? What else would you have?
The radio communication.
How much wireless was it at that point? Was it a portable 88 or whatever it was?
It was a big thing about this size, you know.
In those days, it's difficult to tell portable from not portable. Yeah. Would it be in a vehicle or would you carry it?
Carried it.
And who would be operating that?
A signaller.
You'd actually have a signaller with you. So one of the three was a signaller.
Yeah.
What other equipment would you have?
That was really binoculars, of course, because you're always scanning with binoculars before you start using the...
Now, what would you use them for? Or what are you looking for? Just a preliminary survey, if you like.
Looking for enemy. Or in this case, probably we were looking for... points which had been put up in advance, and we had to locate them and be able to sort of say where those were by the different posts taking their measurements from the different observation posts. Again, you could plot that. It's sort of 0 degree from here, and it's 28 degrees from somewhere else, where the lines cross, that's where they are.
Now, what about, would you have, what sort of map, or would you have, I mean, the artillery would use an artillery board. Would you have one up there with you, an artillery board?
We had maps with us.
But not an artillery board?
No.
So what sort of maps would you have?
Ordinary ordnance maps.
OS maps?
Yeah.
And that was all you'd have? 1 inch, was it 1 inch then to the mile?
1 inch to the mile, yeah.
It wasn't a kilometre to the mile?
No, 1 inch to the mile.
And anything else you'd have with you?
No, that's about it, I think.
And so what would the three of you be doing?
Well, if your role was to locate some point, say they'd picked a church, so we had to identify where it was, because in a sense pretending that would be where a gun was. Then once we'd been up there, surveyed in our position, we'd to locate our exact position.
How would you do that? Just explain.
Usually from known trigonometric points, we'd sort of resect back from them. We'd measure angles back from them, say, you know, we know where that is, we know where that is, we turn the angles to them, we can identify where we are now. You'd have to do that first before you could start operating. But once you've located your position, then you set up the instrument, you'd start searching for whatever it was you're supposed to be looking for.
And the three of you, would you take it in turns to be the driver, wireless operator? What would you do?
Normally it was short term, this training. I mean, you're only up there for a day or something, or a night. Usually the person who's doing the survey, the actual observation, would do the observation all the time.
So what would the other two do? One driver and one wireless, or what?
Well, part of it was redundant. I mean, getting the stuff up there was necessary to have people. It didn't all have to work up there, but you had to get the stuff up there.
So essentially there was one surveyor, one spare who was helping, and a signaller.
It could be that.
Now, so that's when you went up there on the mountain warfare sort of training, you know. Now, what about the actual commando element, the mountain fitness element?
That's right. Well, we used to have to climb. This normally not carrying instruments. You're carrying all your packs, your backpacks with all your blankets and all your equipment in them, your rifle and so on. And then you'd have to climb up, go up a mountain to a certain type, and then come down the other side or in a certain period of time, you're given a time limit. But the one...
How was that? How tough was that for you?
Oh, it was pretty tough. Because I remember the one most of all was Ben Lawers at the side of Loch Tay. We had to go up on top of the mountain and then come down into one end of Loch Tay onto the road that runs along the side of Loch Tay. Then we had to run virtually the whole length. And we were carrying invasion equipment, the full packs. It was heavy stuff we were carrying. And the last 200 yards, we had to pick up one of the other men with all his equipment and carry him that distance in a certain time. Then you had to turn around and he had to carry you. So after you'd done that long run, you climbed a mountain, you'd done a long run carrying this heavy equipment, then you had to carry a man and all his equipment as well for a short period. It was all a toughening up process.
That really is pretty tough. I mean, now the other thing that I noticed, so you're doing calibration.
Yes.
Gun calibration. Now, could you just explain what that was? Because a lot of people don't understand what calibration is.
Yeah.
It's quite a technical business, and there is a very real point to it, isn't it?
Yes. What it means is that each gun has got a rangefinder on it, and they can set that rangefinder to say they're going to fire at, say, 1,000 yards. Now, when they fire their shell, does it go 1,000 yards or not? So what we do, we sort of are observing and say, look, your shell fell there. And they know then whether it fell at 1,000 yards or 100 yards further on or 100 yards short. Then they can alter the rangefinder on the gun with the information we've given them to make it more accurate. So when it says 1,000 yards, it'll land 1,000 yards. But they don't land exactly on the spot. You know, it's one of the artillery training. It's in an elliptical shape where the shells land, but they've got to be within that tolerance.
So you were doing some of that while you were up there?
Yeah, yeah. That was just a service to regiments who were in the, who asked for their guns to be calibrated before they went abroad.
Now, there's a, you were meant to be given a break during this. Montgomery said that you had to have a break of a week if you were on commando training, yeah. The fitness training, I think they mean.
Yeah.
Did you get that week?
Yes, you didn't have a holiday, but you were relieved of all duties in the army. You were still together as a unit. And we were, let's say, at Kenmore then, the end of Loch Tay. And all we did then was competitions. And I mean, the dispatch riders had riding competitions, going around assault courses and so on, and playing football. And so I think the I assume I mentioned there about the officer who took part.
Yes, Grimrot. Seems a strange name. I think that's a nickname, isn't it?
Well, he was hated. He was a bombastic so-and-so who would do anything he could to show his authority. And he was hated. And we understood that our regimental sergeant major went to the officer in command and said, when that officer goes abroad, I can't be responsible for what happens to him. And he must have been told that, Gumrot. And we had one competition there where, you know, they like wheelbarrows where you've got a drum of cable on them and you can wheel this thing along and the wire is sort of played out as you're driving it along. And the competition was to get from one side of the River Tay to the other side of the River Tay and connect up a telephone from one side to the other. Now, officers didn't take part in that. I mean, they didn't take part with the other ranks. But Gumrot specifically asked if he could be in one of the teams. He obviously wanted to show he was one of them. He'd completely changed. And there was a concert afterwards where different people did different things. And Gumrot came up and did a comedy sketch about an officer called Gumrot. He actually did a sketch about an officer called Gumrot.
So he changed his attitude after this
completely.
War. Did it work? I mean, did he become more popular?
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't just a temporary
thing. It was a bubble which burst.
So he was just all right after that?
Yeah, well, I don't remember any problems after that, put it that way.
Now, another thing is you acted as traffic control for a general. Can you tell us that story?
Well, that's a minimal story, really. There was a general going from somewhere in the south of Scotland and going up north. And Braemar, near Balmoral Castle, was one of the places he had to go through. And we had to make sure that there was going to be no obstructions of any kind. And we set up in the middle of Braemar, and we had some time to wait before he was going to arrive. So we decided we'd have a meal. And I'm the only person who sat in the main square of Braemar peeling potatoes.
Now, any other stuff you remember from your time up in Aelith? Well, you know, Aelith and Kenmore, you know, the Tay, generally.
Well, there was a Wings for Victory parade.
Tell me about that.
In Aelith. Well, we were asked to be the military presence there, and I was given the job of training a squad to march there and be very smart, you know, because... the person was murdered on a boat, part of the aristocracy.
Louis Mountbatten.
Yeah, he was coming to take this royal salute at this place. So there was actually a pipe and drum band, that was going to lead us. And we had to march behind this band. So I had to get the troops sort of really smartened up that they were really on the ball. And when we did this parade, marching behind pipe and drums, fabulous experience. You can't get out of step.
Did you have any contact with Mountbatten? Did
no.
Did he make an impression on you at all?
No, only sort of a salute as we went by.
Now, you were there at Aelith till November 43, I see, and then you moved to Johnston, Glasgow.
That was very short.
So, right, that's just on moving.
Yeah.
What were you doing there? Or was it nothing really?
Nothing really. Just very short time there.
And what next?
Just whilst we were being sorted out.
So you're then on your way. Yes. Sorry, I see what you mean. Yeah. And then you're on your way to Cobham in Surrey.
Yeah.
It looks like you seem to be there a little longer.
Yeah. We were moving down towards the ports for the invasion, of course.
Now, what was the camp like at Cobham?
Huts again. In the grounds of a big house.
And what were you doing there?
Really, just ticking over.
Right.
Just, you know, being reminded of our drills and doing exercises of different kinds.
There's a bit of a strange story about Christmas Day there that is quite amusing. You got lost. Can you tell us that? Well, it looks like you get lost in the fog. Can you tell us that story?
Well, it's two different things, I think.
Okay, no, sorry, yes, it's difficult to see quickly.
Yeah, they're two different things. The Christmas one was, it was Christmas Day, and about a mile from the camp at Cobham, there was a canteen run by some church people for the forces. And I went there, and I remember they put a film on. It was Genevieve. They put this film on for us.
Miss Genevieve's post-war.
That's right, Miss Miniver. And when I was coming back from that, of course, it was Christmas evening, and there's all the lights. You could see these houses, although they were blacked out, you could see there was people there, and they're celebrating. And I was thinking, it's Christmas Day. If only somebody would open their door and say, come in, Norman, for a minute. But nobody did. And I got back to the hut, most distraught, really, that nobody had bothered to pick up this lonely soldier that was walking past the door.
How were you getting on the lads? You know, you felt, because were you all privates, or were you sergeants? Because I haven't asked this, actually. What rank were you?
Bombardier.
Bombardier. How were you getting on with the were you all bombardiers?
No.
Okay. So what did it mean, being a bombardier?
You were a lance bombardier, first of all, sort of a step up in responsibility. And then a bombardier, then you tended to be sort of in charge of more men, more responsible.
Did you like the responsibility?
Didn't worry me at all.
Was it what you were used to in the building?
Because I got on well. Throughout my life, I've always got on well with people, and I did in that position that I had no problems in relating to the soldiers I had to deal with.
Do you remember any of them? How you got, you know, any characters that you worked, you know, that served under you?
Well, not in an outstanding way. I remember one who was like a little boy all the time. I couldn't understand why he was in the army. He was obviously older than he looked. And I remember him skiving off once because he lived in London, and I caught him going out, and he hadn't asked permission. So I was waiting for him when he got back. I tore him off a strip.
But you got on well with them generally.
Like. Oh, very well, yeah.
And they got on well with you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a two-way thing.
Sure, yes, no problems.
What about, how did you get on with the higher NCOs and the officers?
No, I never.
Because you talk about.
Well, it almost sounds a bit boastful, really, but I think I became a bit of a favourite with some of them. I think because I was quiet and amenable, you know, and didn't cause trouble. And was trustworthy. Used me shooting the line almost, didn't it?
Not at all.
But I got on well with them.
Now, what about this business of getting lost in the fog? That's quite amusing.
Oh, that was awful. I've heard what this East London fogs were like. A pea super, but you can't hardly put it into words. You literally put your hand out in front of you like that and you wouldn't see it. It was that bad. It's almost unbelievably thick. And I'd been down to this canteen again.
This is in Cobham.
And I was walking back up and suddenly realised I was walking on gravel. There was no gravel in the road. There's a made-up road. But all I could do was keep going slowly, and I landed up in the front of a house. And I couldn't find where the front door was. I was going around holding the wall and railings and that. Eventually I came to a door and knocked on the door, and somebody came out. They knew it all well, of course. They were able to take me down on the road, get me off in the right direction, and there was an AA man going by, used to have a motorbike and sidecar. and he had his headlight shining straight down on the road so he could follow the marking in the road. Because no good having a head, the light wouldn't shine, you know, a few yards. And I went behind him and followed him up to the T road, which really was the corner where the campsite was. So I was as good as home and dry then.